Hello there. This is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Robert Boyers with us. He is the editor of Salmagundi, professor of English at Skidmore College. Robert, how long have you been at Skidmore?
I've been at Skidmore since 1969. So this is my 51st year of teaching at Skidmore.
Wow. Well, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Thanks. Thank you.
Our ostensible topic here is a new book that's just out entitled The Tyranny of Virtue, Identity, the Academy, and the Hunt for Political Heresies. It's out with Scribner's, and it's not that long, and it has a nice mix of detailed experience, what you've seen and heard in the academy, with your own sometimes personal and sometimes objective reflections on what you've seen. And I thought we'd begin by talking about this anecdote with which you open the book. What happened there, and why was that important?
So the anecdote you're speaking of, I guess, is an anecdote that goes all the way back to my sort of undergraduate career. And I was a freshman at the college, and I was as I was thinking about writing about privilege, I began to think about all of the ways in which that idea has been misunderstood, misappropriated, and in many cases used as a kind of an easy weapon. And I think I sort of tried to identify one of the reasons for that. And I thought, well, it's because it's used in an undifferentiated way. So I began to think of, well, what's my privilege? Where have I enjoyed the kinds of privileges that people who are interested in that term like to talk about? And so I thought about the strange privilege I enjoyed as a first-generation college student, first generation in my family, when a professor of mine invited me to his office after turning back a paper I'd written.
This was a Queens College in New York City.
That's it. Queens College in New York, which at that time cost us $20 a year for me to attend. And I thought, of course, that the professor was going to call me in and congratulate me and tell me all the great things that awaited me and so on, because I was so smart and wrote so well and so on. And instead, he got me up there with a colleague of his, told me to speak a little bit so his colleague could hear me, and stopped me after a short while and told me that the sounds I made were such that no one would ever take me seriously if in the future I continued to talk in the same way.
You went to the administration and filed a complaint, I understand.
I certainly did not. At the time, I regarded my professor as something like a god. And since this professor had given me an A+ on the paper, I had reason to think he was very generous and benevolent, and I took very seriously what he said. Of course, no one had ever pointed this out to me before. I was 17 years old, and I guess it's the case that everyone in my Brooklyn family sort of spoke more or less the same way. It did not seem strange or bizarre to us. And I, of course, followed the professor's recommendations completely. I enrolled in a speech course and took speech for 7 semesters at the college. Each night in my little apartment with my parents, stood before the mirror and formed sounds in a way that would make me eventually bring out lovely sounds so that people would take seriously what I had to say. And also, in a way, as I thought about this, I thought, well, this was an extraordinary kind of privilege. I had the privilege of being insulted by my professor, and thereby, because I was not programmed or primed to be offended by this insult, I felt gained a great deal. And that led me to think about all of the different varieties of privilege that people enjoy, and to think also about the fact that, and when you talk about privilege, you have to be very specific and think, who is this person who's enjoying this privilege? What does white privilege mean for my father, who worked in a little store 6 days a week from 8 a.m. till 9 p.m? What kind of white or male privilege did my father enjoy? And even though always I was inclined to accept the fact that privilege is real, it is real. And in some cases, it's very significant. And there really is such a thing, an important thing, as male privilege and white privilege and so on. You can't really hope to talk about a subject like that without being willing to ask very specific questions about individual persons. And that's what I wanted to do in writing my chapter on privilege, which is basically to bear witness to the notion that it's a very hard thing to wrap your head around.
I think that it is wise for that very reason for you to put it in specific experiential terms. Let's go to actual situations, look at the actual people involved, the circumstances that are in play, because, you know, what one person sort of in the abstract might treat as an insult and someone exerting some power out of his privilege over you, you said, no, you can come back to your own experience. Say, no, it was hard. It was humiliating, but it was a gift. I'm so glad that he did that. I'll give you a parallel story. I in my freshman comp class at UCLA back in 1978, where we were actually paying about $400 a year for our training. And he showed samples of our prose up on the screen, and he indicated, you know, something I wrote that had, you know, to be verbs in every single sentence, and they were very repetitive. And he showed it and he said, "Now who wrote this?" And then I raised my hand and he pointed out, "This is a problem." And it was embarrassing. I mean, I wanted to crawl under my chair, but it made its point, and it made me actually spend time trying to go for an hour without using a to-be verb in my speech. That was how much it impressed me. I don't want this to happen again. But my goodness, this is exactly the kind of formation that one needs if one wishes to get a good liberal education. How can someone complain about this?
I don't know. Well, but of course, complaint is very much a part of the culture.
Yes, yes.
And of course, some of the time, you know, legitimately part of the culture. I mean, there are a lot of things to complain about. I've just written a book in which I am complaining about all sorts of things in the culture. And so I can't pretend that other people don't have legitimate reasons some of the time to complain as well.
Well, what I want to assure readers is one reason we're doing this interview is because there's a lot of complaint in the book, but it's a great read. These are not tiresome, repetitive, uninteresting complaints that you make, because it is a mix of important discussions, and you come at them from a very human perspective. When you do things like talk about the Academy, when you talk about the culture of complaint, you talk about the Academy as a, quote, total cultural environment. I think there's some real insight in how you put that. What do you mean it's a total cultural environment?
Well, I mean, it's an environment, in my sense of it, in which more and more everyone is expected to speak with one voice and to embrace in a completely obvious way all of the sort of standard opinions that the Academy itself has ratified as the correct opinions and the correct way to think about them and the correct language to use in talking about them. And this development is relatively new, I think, in the academy. I mean, again, I've been around for a long time. And there have always been, you know, we know, what used to be called varieties of political correctness. And very often in the past, those varieties of political correctness were promoted by conservatives who told us that there were certain things we were not allowed to say, and certain subjects we were not allowed to raise, and all of that. But in recent years, my sense is that in the academy, particularly in the liberal academy, this has taken on another kind of life. And you see it in 100 ways in the life of a school. You see it, for example, in the way that on your email screen, different kinds of consciousness-raising sessions are promoted and advertised every week. For students, for faculty, speakers very often seem to be selected precisely because they're going to tell us the necessary uplifting things we all need to embrace and to parrot once we've heard about them.
Here's one way you put that. Very nicely, early in the book, you talk about the, quote, mandated sessions with lawyers and bureaucrats designed to generate an atmosphere of uniformity, the sense that everyone, so and so, so forth, everyone agrees. And they really want that uniformity. They're quite explicit about that, aren't they?
Oh, completely. Completely. And, you know, there are more than 230 universities right now. The number perhaps has grown. This is a number I got from a book written by Wesley Yang a couple of years ago. But more than 230 universities with official bias response teams to investigate what they call microaggressions. And now, of course, you know, we know that there really are such things as microaggressions. Occasionally, maybe more than occasionally, people say things that make other people feel uncomfortable. And most of us who are decent people like to hope that it's possible to create environments in which that doesn't occur too frequently. But when you generate an atmosphere in which the hunt to identify and call out microaggressions becomes frequent and all-encompassing, then you're creating rather a different kind of environment. And that's the kind of environment I'm talking about when I speak about the university as a total culture. And of course, microaggressions, I mean, think of the term microaggressions, as you ordinarily think of it, refers to relatively small things that, you know, that are not going to, in the normal course of things, turn an institution upside down. For example, calling someone by the wrong name. Okay, confusing one person with another, a microaggression. You don't sufficiently have respect for the person you think you're addressing, and you call that person by another name. This becomes particularly significant when you're confusing, let us say, a minority person, an Asian American, with another Asian American. That is a microaggression. You think, well, you'd like to do something about that. But when you hire bias response teams, not only to look into those kinds of violations, but actually to attempt to punish them and to create an environment in which people are primed to turn people in for making those kinds of errors, then it seems to me you really are creating, again, what I'm calling a total culture, a culture that feels to many people, and of course many faculty members, including especially younger faculty members, speak of this very openly. You're creating a culture that feels like a minefield in which, you know, any false step you take, any slightest error you make, may not only be called out, but punished. And that seems to me very unfortunate.
Do the administrators simply not trust the campus residents to work it out by themselves? Do they feel they have to bring this machinery in for perhaps legal reasons, you know, federal coverage on different forms of discrimination and so on, and that they're overreacting? Or is it just, well, I don't know what it is. What do you think?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think that there's every good reason for administrators to be worried about this sort of thing. When I published a couple of early chapters of my book, only a small portion of my book has actually appeared in periodical form. But when I published a couple of early chapters in the Chronicle of Higher Education, I had letters from dozens of college and university deans and presidents telling me that the situation at their institutions was even worse than what I had described in these chapters. And I think they are running scared. They really do want to defend themselves against possible legal action, suits brought by people within the university community or from people outside. And I understand that completely, and that makes sense. When we're talking about violations and aggressions of importance. But when we're talking about making a mistake about the name of a person, I think that's where things begin to run amok. And of course, in my book, I tell stories about other kinds of violations or aggressions, which are also increasingly subject to the filing of charges. And that, again, has much to do with my sense that something has changed in the environment of the university, and I'm calling that a total culture. Total culture is one in which people need to watch their step at every turn, and I think that goes well beyond what most of us want the university to be.
And you were, when you were young, when you were an undergraduate and early graduate school, you were highly sensitive to political issues and forms of discrimination and so on. You even say that one important influence on you was the work of Herbert Marcuse. I'd like to ask you specifically about that in a moment, but how do you see the activist climate of the late 60s compare to, or mid-60s, compared to the activist climate today? What is the difference, if you were to sum it up?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, my sense of the 60s, I mean, I, of course, I'm a veteran of the 60s. I was in undergraduate school in the early 60s and in graduate school in the mid 60s. And I was a very active political person. I mean, I was an activist on many fronts. I was an anti-war counselor for 3 years, advising young men on how to resist the draft and therefore to resist fighting in the war in Vietnam. And so I was very active politically. My sense is that, and again, maybe this is just my own nostalgia for certain aspects of the 1960s, my sense is that the activists were fighting on behalf of very real issues and very real advances. The situation in the country was very different then, all apart from the fact that we were fighting the war in Vietnam. The situation involving race was dreadful in the 1960s, and there was very good reason for people who were of an activist bent to be involved in those issues. Right now, my sense is that the activism has really been directed to a very large extent at very small, and in some cases even trivial things, which of course people tell themselves are a great deal more important than they are. But this has created an environment in which all sorts of people are able to sort of live comfortable lives and tell themselves they're being political when they shame and call out other people for small violations and aggressions that really don't amount to very much at all.
It really stuns outsiders when they hear students at liberal arts colleges that strike outsiders as highly liberal or even leftist, a place like Williams College, to see the students protesting for the forms of tyranny and racism and sexism going on in those schools. You guys, you're paying $60,000, $70,000 a year to go there. Something here doesn't add up.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There are what might legitimately be called bias incidents that occur at colleges and universities all the time. That is to say, we read about them at Skidmore College all the time when various bias response teams at the school and so on notify us that a particular incident has occurred. Like what? Well, someone has written on a dormitory door a disgusting epithet. Okay, that's real, and you don't want to tolerate that. I want to be as tolerant as I can, but I don't tolerate that, and I agree we have to respond to that and deal with it and so on. But in the normal course of things, at schools like Williams College and Middlebury College and Skidmore College and larger universities, this kind of thing is relatively infrequent. And while we need to be vigilant and alert to those kinds of things, most of the time the energy is expended on very trivial matters.
What would Herbert Marcuse think?
Well, he's of course, as you know, a figure who was enormously important to people of my generation on the left in the 1960s and 70s. And I tell you, in my graduate courses at the New School for Social Research, which I retired from a couple of years ago, I had been teaching as an adjunct professor at the New School for 25 years. In my courses on cultural criticism, I continued right up until a couple of years ago, teaching Marcuse's One-Dimensional Man, so that he remains, for me at least, a figure worth studying, and in many cases worth studying for many of the mistakes that he made and many of the misconceptions promoted in his work. But he was important, I felt then, and I feel now, because of the way that he tried to explain that reason, that the faculty of reason itself had been diminished by being associated with a submission to the obvious facts of life. He wanted to explain how important it was, particularly for students and faculty members and thoughtful people generally, to bring things, this is his language, to bring things out of the self-evident, right? To learn to deliver ourselves from the grip of mere facts. Now, that sounds perhaps a little strange and a little abstract and so on, but it seemed to me then, and it even seems to be now, to have a certain important validity. I mean, when I think, for example, back to the period in which I first discovered Marcuse, like pretty much everybody else of my generation in the 1960s, particularly when he published One Dimensional Man. I was then a war resister, again, and working in resistance organizations in New York City. And one of the things that I discovered when I talked to people of my own generation at that time, people who were not inclined as I was to war resistance, was that they believed that the facts of life dictated that there really was no alternative to observing your draft notice in the way you were supposed to, going and being physically examined and being registered by the draft board, and when the call came, being sent to fight in the war in Vietnam, even if you felt that that war was an unjust war and that it was going to lead to no good. Even if you felt all of those things, reason you felt dictated that you had no choice but to do that. After all, if you didn't do that, federal marshals would eventually come to your door and arrest you and drag you off. They would force you to be physically examined. They would force you to be registered. They would force you to enter the military against your will. And those were the facts of life. And if you didn't do those things, well, you'd go to prison. So that's what reason said. Reason said that there was no choice but to obey. And Marcuse, I think, helped lots of us to feel that actually that is a very unfortunate way to submit to the dictates of reason. And that was useful. On the other hand, as I sort of say at one point in my book, as I remember my infatuation with Marcuse, there were other aspects of Marcuse's work, which also seemed to me attractive at the time, which now that I look back on it, seemed to me idiotic. For example, his promotion of the idea of repressive tolerance. Now, that's a notion, repressive tolerance, right, which is predicated on the notion that to allow freedom of speech is to assist, you know, basically in the propagation of error. If you allow people to say things that are, from your point of view, flatly untrue or misleading, well, you are contributing to the propagation of error, and you can't complain when people go around saying things that are totally unsubstantiated. But of course, to take that, to adopt that position, is to run the risk of assuming that you yourself have all of the right answers to all of those questions, and that you have a kind of an omniscience that allows you to determine which views should and should not be expressed, permitted. And so, again, after a rather short while, I discovered, with the help of a couple of older and better minds, that this aspect of Marcuse really was something that we infatuates had to learn to wean ourselves off of, and I think we did.
I mean, it seems so obvious. Why, a student should logically ask, why should I read something written 200 years ago that is flatly sexist? Why should I have to read any poetry by Ezra Pound, that fascist? Come on.
Yeah, no, exactly. And of course, you of course know very well, I mean, the answer to the question is of course that we want to not only entertain the widest possible range of ideas, but that also because the play of mind, when the mind is really a first-rate mind, as in many respects Pound's was, and as in many respects Marcuse's was, the play of mind is what it's all about. I mean, that's what we want. We want to subject ourselves to the play of mind, and that's what we get, even when the first-rate mind is enthralled to opinions or ideas that we deplore.
I think that phrase, the play of mind, should be very much kept in mind by all teachers. Yes, this is the justification for reading that old stuff. Now, as editor of Salmagundi, you have a lot of contact with writers as well who aren't academics, or not primarily academics. And one of the things you say in the book is that your writer friends tell you that, quote, this is not a good time for ideas. Why do they say that?
Well, I think they say it because they have observed that ideas are more and more readily used for purposes that have really nothing to do with those ideas per se. That ideas are deployed,
instrumentalized or...
Yes, yeah. And so, you know, you hear people going around and parroting ideas in ways that really have nothing to do with the substance of those ideas. If you think, for example, of the idea of privilege, right, which we've already spoken about a little bit, privilege is it's an important idea. It's an interesting idea, but it's also important. Because there really is such a thing as privilege, and because we want to understand it, and we want to understand it particularly when we hope to address and do something about inequality. And part of what we do when we address inequality is to think about privilege. Why do certain people have a leg up in the competition of life? And how can we do something about altering that situation? That's something that people of a liberal disposition think about a great deal. So privilege can be a very important and useful idea. But there are many situations certainly in the ordinary run of academic life in which privilege is deployed in a way that is fundamentally unserious and really has nothing whatsoever to do with any serious preoccupation we have with making things better. I'll give you an example. There was a speaker invited actually to speak at Skidmore College by the president of the college, Philip Glatzbach, a couple of years ago. He was a speaker, I can't think of his name right now, but he was a person from Phi Beta Kappa Society. And he gave a lunch talk. And there were, about 200 faculty members present at this talk. And in the course of the talk, he addressed some of the kinds of questions we're talking about today, including the question of microaggressions and when it is legitimate and not legitimate to get all hot and bothered and worked up about things that are happening. And he said at a certain point, it is essential, I remember this so vividly, that it is essential to differentiate between one kind of situation and another. He said, there is a difference between kicking a dog and accidentally tripping over a dog, right? And if we don't bear that difference in mind, we will go off and accuse people of crimes and violations when in the life of an institution, we have better things to do with our time. So when he said that, a hand went up from a younger faculty member in the audience who said, sir, do you realize that you have just exercised white privilege in speaking to us in the way that you have just done? And he said, excuse me, I don't really understand what you're saying. You don't understand what I'm saying. Well, I mean, it's quite obvious, right? I mean, here you are, you're a white man, you're exercising white privilege in telling us, you know, the way we're supposed to think and the way we're supposed to differentiate this thing from that thing. And I mean, it was kind of a stunning sort of invocation of the idea. He was wonderful. He was wonderful, very practiced speaker. And he said, well, that's interesting, because that's something you try to say when you're sort of gathering your thoughts. And that was interesting. He said, and of course, I acknowledge that I am the beneficiary of many different kinds of privilege. And he said, and of course, you obviously, as a faculty member at a liberal arts institution like this, are also the beneficiary of many different kinds of privilege. And when we're talking about privilege, I guess it's an important thing for us all to sort of get together and acknowledge those things. But it is also, I think, important to acknowledge that sometimes the use of the word privilege might is really completely incidental. One might even say irrelevant to the thing we're discussing. So that seemed to me an extraordinary response. And of course, I would have to imagine that the faculty member who spoke up probably had at least a third or more of the room with her. And those people were not at all persuaded by what the Phi Beta Kappa speaker had to say in the way of response.
You know, that brings us some of the words you've said, such as seriousness and privilege. I want to just read how you close the book, because you talk about what is to be done, but you really end with several points of, quote, what is not to be done. And I'm going to read a few of them. Here's what is not to be done. The promulgation of ideas entertained without seriousness, that is, without any corresponding consideration of what would be entailed were they actually to be effected. 2. The use of ideas such as privilege, expropriation, ableism, and microaggression to sow hostility, persecute other members of a community, and make meaningful conversation impossible. You have a few more of those, but your last word is, what is to be done? Answer. Fight with all one's heart against what is not to be done. The book is The Tyranny of Virtue, Identity, the Academy, and the Hunt for Political Heresies, just out with Scribner's. Thank you, Professor Boyers.
Thank you so much. Delight. Thank you.